It's Thursday. Yes. No, it isn't. Gotcha. It's Tuesday, January 24th, 2006. It's time for the Tuesday Kill Radio News. It's 6 o'clock-ish. This from ArakBodyCount.net. Number of civilians reported killed by military intervention in Iraq, minimum 28,088. Maximum 31,676.
The scumbag, the motherfucking president. Fucking piece of shit. Scumbag, asshole, fucking retard. Scumbag, scumbag, you fucking piece of shit. Little fucking piece of shit. Fuck you.
That's a little ditty by King Missile about the president. Yeah, I was just reading from ArakBodyCount.net. That's what the latest information is. Somewhere between 28,000... 88 and 31,676 civilians. Doesn't include the military. A lot of news. I got some media files for you today. I got some articles to read. Of course, mom's emails. And wow, a lot of crazy stuff going on today. Of course, they confirmed Judge Alito. You hate women. You'll love Alito. Well, I can't, you know. Really, is anybody surprised? How could they be surprised? What I think is interesting is how they have these confirmation hearings on the television, and we're all acting like we're a part of it. You have all these commercials and stuff, and everybody's like, oh, you know, you confirm, don't confirm. He's great. He's an asshole, you know, whatever. But it didn't. You know, this is a recent development. People didn't know anything about these hearings before. You know, 100 years ago, people weren't watching CNN and wondering, you know, is this judge going to get confirmed or not? The questions were probably something like, you know, so you belong to the Klan, did you? Can you start on Monday? You know, whatever. Now it's all like, you know, hey, don't answer this question, don't answer that question, and we might be able to sneak you in. Roe v. Wah? Well, enough of that. Let's go on. Hopefully these media files will play and Kill Radio computer won't let me down. We're going to talk. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, although I do believe in conspiracies. So later I'm going to play an excerpt from a documentary film about 9/11 and why the people who made it believe that the World Trade Center was actually a controlled demolition as opposed to just the tragedy that it was. But before we get to that, I can play some other stuff. This one is something I came across today on the net from LibertyNewsTV.com, which is one of my favorite websites now. And let's watch it together. This is a little clip about, you know, where we stand. Check it out. And we're loading.
In December, just before the U.S. Congress went into recess, political opposition to the arrogance, secrecy, and cruelty of the Bush administration seemed to reach a critical mass. Even the regular pundits of the mainstream media could not conceal their deep sense of outrage.
Wolf, good afternoon. Who cares about whether the Patriot Act gets renewed? Want to abuse our civil liberties? Just do it.
This is Jack Cafferty speaking.
Who cares about the Geneva Conventions? Want to torture prisoners? Just do it. Who cares about rules concerning the identity of CIA agents? Want to reveal the name of a covert operative? Just do it. Who cares about whether the intelligence concerning WMDs is accurate? Want to invade Iraq? Just do it. Who cares about qualifications to serve on the nation's highest court? Want to nominate a personal friend with no qualifications? Just do it. And the latest outrage, which I read about in the New York Times this morning. Who cares about needing a court order to eavesdrop on American citizens? Want to wiretap their phone conversations? Just do it. What a joke. A very cruel, very sad joke.
Torture, corruption, religious intolerance, and greed. Citizens all over the globe now associate these moral failings with U.S. politics and policy. That's not our opinion. It's a fact. New research by the Pew Global Attitudes Project shows that the reputation of the United States has fallen dramatically among even our closest allies, most notably Canada and Britain. and support from former friends such as Spain has plummeted, primarily due to strong opposition to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But this worldwide poll also offers clues on how to restore America's image as a moral leader. Doing so, however, would require a massive shift in policy, away from the current neocon strategy of reshaping foreign governments using military force. Notice how the modest generosity of the U.S. toward the Asian tsunami victims has boosted goodwill toward Americans, particularly in Indonesia, a largely Muslim nation. Unfortunately, those positive gains have been largely negated by anger over the Iraq occupation, coupled with dismay at the re-election of George W. Bush. More than two-thirds of citizens worldwide opposed Mr. Bush's reinstatement. A majority of people in other nations now view Americans as greedy, violent, and excessively religious. More than half of our own citizens, in contrast, believe that we all need to become more religious. That view is shared by many Muslim nations. That Pew survey does not include damage done by the most recent slew of White House revelations.
Well, that's unfortunate. What can you say about that? Well, let's just keep on voting for him. Keep on keeping on. Well, that's got me in quite a mood. I'm going to play another one, also from LibertyNewsTV.com. This one is about our favorite national pastime. No, not oppression of the Indians.
First, there's the torture problem. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice had this to say as she danced around the issue of secret CIA torture centers.
If you are going to uncover plots, if you are going to get to people before they commit their crimes, that is largely an intelligence function. And if you don't get to them before they commit their crimes, unlike in the traditional law enforcement area, they will have committed mass murder. Against innocent people, to do everything that you can to protect people, and that means getting to the perpetrators of such crimes before they can commit them.
Just as an aside, that little clip from that conference is apparently not available on the on their website, on the
the perpetrators of such crimes before they can commit
them. On the U.S. State Department's website.
That comment may help explain the cavalier attitude the Bush administration has toward imprisonment and torture of untried prisoners. Alberto Gonzalez, now U.S. Attorney General, denies any U.S. support for torture. While appearing on CNN, however, his narrow definition of the word clearly left the door open for future abuses.
One very sensitive interrogation technique is this waterboarding, where the detainee or the suspect thinks he is drowning. Is that something that you think is acceptable?
What I will tell you is that the Congress has defined what torture is, and it is the intentional infliction of severe, I emphasize the word severe, the intentional infliction of severe physical or mental pain or suffering.
Gonzalez, it should be recalled, helped smooth the way for Abu Ghraib and the current torture controversy. While serving as Bush's White House legal counsel, he penned this memo suggesting the U.S. could ignore the Geneva Conventions with regard to torture. Republican Senator John McCain, himself a victim of torture, put forward legislation that would require that the Army Field Manual be used as a strict guide for acceptable interrogation techniques, barring inhumane and cruel treatment. McCain's bill passed the House, despite opposition from 120 Republicans and one Democrat.
Putting a guy on a waterboard who is about to blow up a bunch of soldiers in Baghdad and holding him under the water for a little bit to make him tell us what he's going to do is not what I call terrible. We're not pulling out their fingernails or cutting off their heads.
We'll be right back.
And back we are. So if you go to LibertyNewsTV.com, you can download their entire monthly video. They're pretty well organized. Not like my show. No, not at all. I'm all over the place today. So, get this. Remember how there was this whole storm called Katrina, and all these people lost their homes and in many cases their, you know, their lives and of course their jobs and everything. And you had this sneaking suspicion that maybe if we had a better administration that was informed and could do things with information once they got it, that maybe some of this tragedy would have been avoided. Well, brace yourselves, because apparently you were right. W House, which I think actually stands for White House, but whatever, accused of foot-dragging in Katrina probe. This is from Reuters. Right on. Senator Joseph Lieberman, the top Democrat on the Senate panel investigating the government's botched response to Hurricane Katrina on Tuesday, accused administration officials of failing to cooperate and trying to run out the clock on the congressional probe. The problems begin at the White House, where there has been a near total lack of cooperation that has made it impossible, in my opinion, for us to do the thorough investigation we have a responsibility to do, Lieberman said in a hearing held by the Senate Homeland Security Committee. The Connecticut Democrats said the administration has delivered few of the documents requested by the committee and hindered its ability to obtain information from agencies involved in preparing and responding to the hurricane.
There has been no assertion of executive privilege, just a refusal to answer, Lieberman said. My staff believes that the Department of Homeland Security has engaged in a conscious strategy of slow-walking our investigation in the hope that we would run out of time to follow the investigation's natural progression to where it leads,
Lieberman said, before going into a rendition of It Ain't Easy Being Green. The committee has held several hearings on Katrina, and Chairman Susan Collins, a Maine Republican, said it is entering the final phase of the probe. The next few hearings will focus on the most troubling aspects of the response to the hurricane, which devastated Gulf Coast states and flooded New Orleans. White House spokesman and high school bully Scott McClellan insisted the administration was cooperating with the probe. There are thousands of documents that have been provided to the committee. There are numerous administration officials who have gone before the committee and testified, he said. But Lieberman said key documents were missing that could explain why a Department of Homeland Security warning about the potential dangers of the storm went unheeded. A Federal Emergency Management Agency document dated August 27th, 2 days before the storm hit, warned of the potential for heavy damage, widespread power outages, and possible flooding in New Orleans. Lieberman said the White House received the report several hours before the storm made landfall. What happened to that report, he asked. Why was the president left so uninformed that he said 4 days later, I don't think anyone anticipated the breach of the levees, followed by a series of ums and blinking behavior. Wow! You'd think this was the same president in the White House when 9/11 happened. Oh, it was the same president. God, you know? Amazing. Amazing. Speaking of a big mess. Oh, by the way, Disney bought Pixar, and that affects your life. No, I guess it doesn't. Panel sends Alito nomination to full U.S. Senate. Also from Reuters. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted along party lines on Tuesday, surprise, surprise, to narrowly approve President George W. Bush's nomination of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court, moving the 55-year-old conservative a step closer to confirmation by the full Republican-led Senate. With 10 Republicans voting yes and 8 Democrats voting no, please no, the committee sent the nomination to the 100-member Senate. The full chamber is to begin debate on Wednesday with a confirmation vote, also largely along party lines, expected as early as the end of this week. If confirmed, Alito will crumple up the Bill of Rights and wipe his butt with it. No, that's not what it says. If confirmed, Alito, a federal appeals judge since 1990, would replace retiring moderate conservative Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and could help move the high court to the right on abortion, or as some call it, the wrong, as well as civil rights and other hot-button issues. I love it when articles say hot-button issues like they're trendy, as opposed to just, you know, extremely, extremely important. White House spokesman and high school bully Scott McClellan said, "We urge the Senate to move forward with a swift up or down vote so that he can begin serving on our nation's highest court." The committee's vote on Alito marked the first time it had approved a Supreme Court nominee strictly along party lines since Democratic President Woodrow Wilson's successful nomination of Louis Brandeis in 1916, a spokesman said. So far, just one of the Senate's 44 Democrats, Crazy Ben Nelson of Nebraska, has announced he will vote for Alito. All about a handful of others are expected to oppose his appointment to the lifetime post. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid of Nevada said he would oppose the nomination. Quote, "It is unfortunate the president made such a divisive nomination. At a time when the president is abusing his power at every turn, I cannot vote to confirm a judge who won't be an independent check on the executive branch," Reid said. Before the committee vote, Republicans hailed Alito as the Messiah. No, as a fair-minded, mainstream conservative who had received the American Bar Association's top rating. But Democrats charged Alito had staked out some extreme positions on such matters as abortion rights, civil rights, and presidential powers. I don't know if any of you out there care about those things. By the way, Disney bought Pixar. I just thought I'd throw that out there. Judiciary Chairman Arlen Specter, moderate yet insane Pennsylvania Republican, said he believed Alito was qualified. Quote, "His personal background is exemplary. His professional qualifications are outstanding. His educational achievements are of the highest order. God damn it, confirm him." Specter also said he believes Alito's colleagues on the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals answered many critics when they testified at his confirmation hearing that, quote, "He is not an ideologue, and he does have an open mind. We've seen it." The Senate vote on Alito is expected to be far closer than the 78-22 one that the android John Roberts, Bush's first nomination to the High Court, received in September in being confirmed as U.S. Chief Justice. But no Democrat has threatened to block the nomination with a filibuster, since they do not appear to have the votes to sustain such a procedural roadblock, nor the votes to really do anything but look silly. Senator John Cornyn, a Texas Republican, said, "If qualifications, integrity, fairness, and judicial philosophy were all that mattered in this process, Judge Alito would have been voted out of the committee unanimously. But the new rule is that any nominee who refuses to promise to impose a liberal agenda from the bench is subjected to tactics of distortion and smear." He then picked his nose and wiped it on his red tie. Senator Dianne Feinstein, California Democrat, said the committee was sharply divided because, quote, "The president has clearly indicated that he wants to take the court even further to the right than it has been in the last 10 years. I actually watched some C-SPAN today, and a boxer is saying, well, if you want women to have the right to choose, you can't confirm Alito, so I'm not going to vote for him. Thanks, Barbara. I wish there were more than one of you. I wish there were more than 8 of you. 10. I wish there were more than 10 of you. So, yeah, so that's what's going on in this funny little country of ours. The war. Supreme Court. Torture. Natural disasters. Oh, and Disney is buying Pixar. So, why don't we listen to another media file? A friend of mine sent me this the other day. Hope it plays. This is an excerpt. Let me read what it says here. It says, "This is a clip from the new documentary, Loose Change, which features firefighters and other eyewitnesses discussing explosions at the World Trade Center and examines the physical evidence." I'm not necessarily promoting this or agreeing with it, but I did watch it and did think it was interesting. So why don't you watch it with me or listen with me. And, you know, come to your own conclusions. Clearly, there are a lot of questions missing answers. So, here we go. On the record, the controlled demolition of the WTC.
This meeting on the 36th floor of One Liberty Plaza across the street from the World Trade Center and caught the entire first attack on tape. A second explosion could be heard 9 seconds after the crash. The windows in the lobby of the North Tower were blown out, and marble panels were blown off of the walls. This was brushed off as an explosion from a raging fireball that went barreling down the elevator shafts. However, there is no soot, no fire, no fuel residue. Instead, the entire lobby is coated with a fine dust, which is the signature of high explosives. Mike Pecoraro was working in the 6th sub-basement of the North Tower when the first plane struck. Mike and his friend ascended to the sea level, and when they arrived, they found that the machine shop was gone. There was nothing there but rubble. We're talking about a 50-ton hydraulic press. Gone. They saw a perfect line of smoke streaming through the air. You could stand here, and 2 inches over, you couldn't breathe. The two made their way to the parking garage, but found that that, too, was gone. There were no walls, there was rubble on the floor, and you couldn't see anything. They went up 2 more levels to the building's lobby. As they reached the B level, they were astonished to see a steel and concrete fire door that weighed about 300 pounds, wrinkled up like a piece of aluminum foil on the floor. The whole lobby was soot and black, elevator doors were missing, the marble was missing off of some of the walls, the west windows were all gone, broken glass everywhere, the revolving doors were all broken and their glass was gone. Every sprinkler head was going off. Could an explosion 90 floors above cause uniform damage to the lobby and sub-basements of the North Tower? But don't take their word for it. Ask the Fire Department of New York. First, we have this interview from the Naudé Brothers documentary on 9/11.
Like the house in the woods, there's nobody there. Fuck, what do we do? We made it outside, we made it about a block.
We made it at least 2 blocks, and we started running. Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was like, it was if they had detonated.
Yeah,
you know,
detonated.
If they were planning to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
All the way down. I was watching it and running.
Just ran up west.
And then you just saw this cloud of shit chasing you down.
Couldn't outrun it.
Just ran up west street.
In these interviews, numerous firefighters from Ladder 7 describe a loud explosion preceding the collapses, not to mention extensive damage to the lobby of the North Tower.
I heard a loud boom. And my first thing, I was right at the desk there, on the left-hand side when you come into Tower 1. And I walked out, you know, I didn't go out. I walked to where all the doorway was, the glass were broken, and I looked out. And I seen in the building across the street, I seen the shadow coming, I seen just the shadow in the building across the street coming down. And
I wasn't expecting to see the damage that I saw in the lobby and the people, the bodies, the burnt people, the injured people. I really wasn't prepared for that.
The lobby is about 6 stories high, and the lobby looked as though a bomb had exploded there. All the glass was taken out. There were 10-foot by 10-foot. Marble panels that were once walls, they were loose from the wall of the Trade Center.
I went around by the freight elevator and I could see it was just blown. It was just a giant 30th floor. We hear another explosion. And at that time we heard a huge explosion.
Firefighter Louis Caccioli told People Weekly on September 24th, "I was taking firefighters up in the elevator to the 24th floor to get in position to evacuate workers. On the last trip up, a bomb went off. We think there were bombs set in the building." Then in the radio transmissions from September 11th, firefighters reported numerous additional explosions going off within the buildings.
"See, I got an eyewitness who said there was an explosion on floor 7-8. 7-8.
Warren Street because of the secondary explosion. We've got numerous people covered with dust from the secondary explosion.
And we got another explosion on the tower, 1013.
Tower 2 has had a major explosion and what appears to be a complete collapse surrounding the entire area. Who's involved in the secondary explosion at Tower 1 camp?
Moments ago, I spoke to the chief of safety for the New York City Fire Department. He received word of the possibility of a secondary device, that is another bomb going off, but he said that there was another explosion which took place, and then an hour after the first hit here, there was another explosion that took place. He thinks that there were actually devices that were planted in the building. We are continuing to hear explosions here downtown, and what we've been...
Chief Palmer had reached the fire on the 78th floor of the South Tower and devised a plan to put it out.
I saw the pockets of fire. We should be able to knock it down with two lines. Where you at? 78th floor. Numerous 1045 call horns.
If the 78th floor was a raging inferno like the government would have us believe, then Palmer wouldn't have gotten as far as he did, and certainly wouldn't have been able to put it out. Kevin Ryan, an employee at Underwriters Laboratories, the company that certified the steel components that were used in the World Trade Center, sent a letter to Frank Gehl of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, arguing that the steel used in the World Trade Center met all the standards for resistance against a fire. We know that the steel components were certified to ASTM E11-9. The time temperature curves from this standard require the samples to be exposed to temperatures around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for several hours. And as we all agree, the steel applied met those specifications. Additionally, I think we can all agree that even unfireproof steel will not melt until reaching red-hot temperatures of nearly 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. This story just does not add up. If steel from those buildings did soften or melt, I'm sure we can all agree that this was certainly not due to jet fuel fires of any kind, let alone the briefly burning fires in those towers. That fact should be of great concern to all Americans. Alternatively, the contention that this steel did fall at temperatures around 250 degrees Celsius suggests that the majority of deaths on September 11th were due to a safety-related feature. That suggestion should be of great concern to my company. The issue of the World Trade Center's collapse is at the crux of the story of September 11th. Ryan's statements directly contradict claims from the government and so-called experts stating that 2,000-degree heat inside the World Trade Center caused the towers to collapse. Days after writing this letter, Kevin Ryan was fired from his position. The collapse of the World Trade Center was picked up by Columbia University's observatory in Palisades, New York, 21 miles north of the World Trade Center. The South Tower registered as a 2.1 earthquake. The North Tower registered as a 2.3 earthquake. Won Young Kim told the American Free Press that their seismographs pick up underground explosions from a quarry 20 miles away. These blasts are caused by 80,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate and cause local earthquakes between magnitude 1 and 2. The 1993 truck bomb at the World Trade Center did not register because it was not coupled to the ground. And yet, on September 11th, both towers registered a magnitude 2 earthquake. In November 2001, Lerner Lamb said, "During the collapse, most of the energy of the falling debris was absorbed by the towers and the neighboring structures, converting them into rubble and dust, or causing other damage, but not causing significant ground shaking." Mark Loiseau, the president of Controlled Demolition Incorporated, told the American Free Press that in the basements of the World Trade Center, where 47 central support columns were connected to the bedrock, hot spots of literally molten steel were discovered more than a month after September 11th. These incredibly hot areas were found at the bottom of the elevator shafts of the main towers, down 7 basement levels. The molten steel was found 3, 4, and 5 weeks later, when the rubble was being removed. He said that molten steel was also found at World Trade Center 7. The highest temperature was in the east corner of the South Tower, where a temperature of 1,377 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded. The molten steel in the basement was more than double that temperature. Do you still think that jet fuel brought down the World Trade Center? In all the videos of the collapses, explosions can be seen bursting from the buildings 20 to 30 stories below the demolition wave. Here, 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 here. and here. Etienne Sauret was filming her documentary, WTC The First 24 Hours, and caught both collapses on tape. Watch carefully. The tripod shakes exactly 9 seconds before the tower begins collapsing.
Obviously, some of this
and a small piece of debris is knocked off of the right-hand side of the building.
Entirely to radio. You're going to have to download this yourself. You can do so from prisonplanet.com. Look for the link to the video.
Not to mention
the record,
video of the second impact. An explosion is clearly seen bursting from the building more than 50 feet from the crash. You're probably asking, if there were bombs in the building, how would they get in there without anyone noticing? Ben Fountain, a financial analyst who worked in the World Trade Center, told People magazine that in the weeks before 9/11, there were numerous unannounced and unusual drills where sections of both the Twin Towers and Building 7 were evacuated for security reasons. Scott Forbes, an employee that worked at Fiduciary Trust in the South Tower, told Victor Thorne of Wing TV that his company was given 3 weeks advance notice that New York's Port Authority would take out power in the South Tower from the 48th floor up. The reason given was that the Port Authority was performing a cabling upgrade to increase the WTC's computer bandwidth. Forbes stated that a power down had never been initiated prior to this occasion. As a result of having its electricity cut, the World Trade Center's security cameras were rendered inoperative, as were its ID systems and elevators to the upper floors. There were plenty of engineers going in and out of the World Trade Center who had free access throughout the building due to its security system being knocked out. Also, video cameras on top of the World Trade Center, which were used to feed daily images to local TV stations, were strangely inoperative on September 11th. Daria Cord, a guard in the North Tower, told Newsday that security detail was working 12-hour shifts for 2 weeks before 9/11. But on Thursday the 6th, bomb-sniffing dogs were abruptly removed from the building. So who authorized all this? President Bush's brother, Marvin, is a principal at Securicom, a company that provides security for United Airlines, Dulles International Airport, and from the early 1990s up to 9/11, the World Trade Center. If only we could examine the debris from the World Trade Center and figure out what happened. Unfortunately, most of it was immediately shipped out of the country to be melted down. Maybe we should ask Controlled Demolition Incorporated, who was responsible for cleaning up after both September 11th and the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. But I think the answer is simple enough. What happened on September 11th was a carefully planned controlled demolition. It was a psychological attack on the American people, and it was pulled off with military precision.
Well, what else can you say about that? I don't know. Go to prisonplanet.com if you want to download that and view it again. Raises some interesting questions. I don't have the answers for it. I can't even say for sure if it matters. I'm not sure what matters anymore. Fictional war, fictional president, fictional everything. Speaking of a fictional president, here's another article. It's time for Mom's emails. It's the latest from Mom. She sent me an article from the Washington Post, Sunday, January 22nd, by Zachary Goldfarb, called "As Elections Near, Officials Challenge Balloting Security." It's good fun. As the Leon County Supervisor of Elections, Ian Sancho's job is to make sure voting is free of fraud. But the most brazen effort lately to manipulate election results in this Florida locality was carried out by Sancho himself. 4 times over the past year, Sancho told computer specialists to break into his voting system, and on all 4 occasions they did, changing results with what the specialists described as relatively unsophisticated hacking techniques. To Sancho, the results showed the vulnerability of voting equipment manufactured by Ohio-based Diebold Election Systems, which is used by Leon County and many other jurisdictions around the country. Sancho's most recent demonstration was last month. Harry Hursti, a computer security expert from Finland, manipulated the, quote, memory card, end quote, that records the votes of ballots run through an optical scanning machine. Then, in a warehouse a few blocks from his office in downtown Tallahassee, Sancho and seven other people held a referendum. The question on the ballot: can the votes of the Diebold system be hacked using the memory card? Two people marked yes on their ballots, and six no. The optical scan machine read the ballots, and the data was transmitted to a final tabulator. The result? Seven yes. One no. Was it possible for a disgruntled employee to do this and not have the elections administrator find out? Sancho asked. The answer was yes. Diebold and some officials have criticized Sancho's experiments and said his conclusions about the vulnerability of electronic voting systems are unfounded. What Sancho did, quote, is analogous to if I gave you the keys to my house and told you when I was gone, said David Baer, a Diebold spokesman. As Baer sees it, Sancho's experiment involved giving hackers complete unfettered access to the equipment, something a responsible elections administrator would never allow. Questions about the security of electronic voting machines have been circulating widely in recent years, but many of the concerns have been dismissed as the fantasies of internet conspiracy theorists or sore loser partisans who could not accept that their candidates simply got fewer votes than a guy who can barely speak English. Okay, I had to throw that in. Critics have not demonstrated that any real elections have had returns altered by the manipulation of electronic voting systems. The questions raised by Sancho, who has held his post since 1989, show how the concerns are being taken more seriously among elections professionals. While electronic voting systems hold promise for improving the election process, the Government Accountability Office said in a report to Congress last year, there are still pressing concerns about security and reliability, design flaws, and other issues. The questions about electronic balloting have become widespread as states and counties move to upgrade equipment, as required by the 2002 Help America Cheat to Get Republicans Elected Act. Help America Vote Act. The law and new state regulations were enacted to make voting more accessible and more accurate, a response to the controversy generated by the contested outcome in Florida in the 2000 presidential election. Schmelection. Since the federal law was passed, though, a hodgepodge... Man, that's a great word. A hodgepodge of federal and state requirements and debates over the best technology have complicated the task of upgrading. In a recent survey by the National Association of Secretaries of State, 17 of 43 states that responded said they expected to miss a congressionally imposed January 1st, 2006 deadline to upgrade voting systems. Election officials have repeatedly clashed with voting machine manufacturers. In Connecticut, for example, Secretary of State Susan Mischievous, you know, B-Y-S-I-E-W-I-C-Z, verdict is still out, how to pronounce that, said she would scrap her plans to replace her state's lever machines after the company she planned to buy from misrepresented itself in negotiations about how accessible the machines would be for people with disabilities. In Miami-Dade County, Florida, the elections chief, the third in 5 years, is thinking about tossing out touchscreen systems installed after 2000. The concern is that they do not leave a paper trail that auditors could examine in a disputed election and are expensive to use. In California, the Secretary of State recently asked Hursti to investigate whether Diebold machines the state was considering had similar vulnerabilities. The events that set in motion Hursti and Sancho meeting and a new wave of concern over today's voting technologies started in 2003 when a Seattle-based activist named Bev Harris released thousands of Diebold documents she said she found on an unsecured portion of the company's website. Some computer scientists said the documents showed Diebold systems were vulnerable to attack. Today, more than 800 jurisdictions use their technology, Harris said. She wanted to find a way to test whether those vulnerabilities could be exploited. Sancho volunteered his equipment to be tested by experts Harris would select. Harris recruited computer expert Herbert Thompson, and on February 14, 2005, in Tallahassee, Thompson met with Sancho and tried to crack the Diebold system remotely. The first attempt failed. On a second attempt, by directly accessing a computer where the votes are counted in a final tally, he manipulated returns. They used a local high school election for the experiment. In May, two more tests were held, this time with Hursti present. Using a device bought for about $200, he was able to easily alter the final vote by changing the program stored on the memory card. You have to admit these systems are vulnerable and act accordingly, Hursty said. Diebold took a dim view of the experiments. On June 8th, a senior company lawyer faxed Sancho. Quote, "You have willfully and intentionally allowed the manipulation of memory cards related to your elections. We believe this to have been a very foolish and irresponsible act." End quote. The response frustrated Sancho. More troubling than the test itself was the manner in which Diebold simply failed to respond to my concerns, or the concerns of citizens who believe in American elections, he said. I really think they're not engaged in this discussion of how to make elections safer, end quote. He's also critical of state officials, who he believes should have caught the vulnerabilities earlier. He said that vendors such as Diebold have too much influence in the administration of elections, a view that resonated with Lita Rodriguez Tassif, the founder of the Miami-Dade Election Reform Coalition. Sancho is truly an advocate for voters, she said. What he is doing in Leon County goes completely against the grain of county election commissioners elsewhere, who are allowing vendors to dictate how to run their elections. Johns Hopkins University computer science professor Avi Rubin, who is leading a group that has received a $7.5 million grant from the National Academy of Sciences to research election technology, said the vulnerabilities of electronic systems, including new touch screen voting machines, point to the need for a paper trail in any election. The more I say we need voting to rely on paper, he said. About 26 states require paper ballots, according to Verified Voting, an advocacy group. Jenny Nash, a spokesman for Florida's Secretary of State, said in the end, the integrity of any voting system must be protected by the local officials who administer elections. Machines are designed and certified to operate in a secure environment and under secure procedures that each supervisor puts in place and follows directly, she said. So, there we are. Yet again, further evidence that your vote does not count. Earlier, we were listening to some stuff from Liberty News TV, and they were talking about Gonzalez and his charming defense of torture in his definition, that it's got to be really, 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 really bad for it to be considered torture. And here's Gonzalez in the news again. This from Reuters. Gonzalez defends domestic spying. Good times. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez defended President George W. Bush's domestic eavesdropping program as lawful on Tuesday in the latest attempt by administration to counter criticism of the surveillance adopted after the September 11 attacks. Gonzalez faced critics head-on during his speech at the Georgetown University Law Center, when a group of students donned black hoods and held a sign in protest, while others stood silently with their backs to Gonzalez as he spoke. And acknowledging that not everyone agreed with the National Security Agency spying program, Gonzalez denied that Bush was violating laws by authorizing the NSA to monitor international phone calls and emails by Americans suspected of links to terrorism without the approval of a special secret court. From the outset, the Justice Department thoroughly examined this program against Al-Qaeda and concluded that the president is acting within his power in authorizing it, said Gonzalez, who did not stop speaking while about 20 protesters stood with their backs to him. These activities are lawful. Critics say the program violates the U.S. Constitution, which some may recall was a piece of paper. It had some writing on it. Nobody really uses it anymore. And a 1978 law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, which makes it illegal to spy on U.S. citizens in the United States without the approval of the special court. News of the covert spying program sparked an outcry by Democrats and Republicans, probably mostly Democrats, with many lawmakers and rights groups questioning its legality. Gonzalez is due to testify on the matter at a Senate hearing on February 6th. Gonzalez said Bush has inherent constitutional powers to conduct warrantless surveillance to detect or prevent an attack. He also said a resolution passed by the U.S. Congress after September 11th authorizing the use of military force gave Bush the right to do whatever the fuck he wants, including the right to approve the eavesdropping. The NSA's focused terrorist surveillance program falls squarely within the broad authorization of the congressional resolution, even though, as some have argued, the resolution does not expressly mention surveillance. If you can keep up with this guy, you're smarter than me. Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid disagreed, which Democrats do best, disagree, and accused the administration of playing politics with national security. If the president wanted to expand the authority he already has to wiretap anyone who might be communicating with terrorists, then he should have come to the Congress to get that authority, Reid said in a statement. The president needs to explain why his current authority was not good enough. Gonzalez said the NSA program was necessary because it was more agile than FISA and allowed for quick action. We have to remember that we're talking about a wartime foreign intelligence program, Gonzalez said. It is imperative for national security reasons that we can detect reliably, immediately, and without delay whenever communications associated with Al-Qaeda enter or leave the United States. We all agree that there should be appropriate checks and balances. Except for us, we don't agree, but we all agree on our branches of government. But the terrorist surveillance program operated by the NSA requires the maximum in speed and agility. Since even a very short delay may make the difference between success and failure in preventing the next attack. You're all going to die, do you hear me? You're all going to die, and I'm going to be laughing when it happens. And then they asked him to leave. That's it for the news, folks. Downward spiral. That's what I'm going to call today's news hour. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the audio clips. People who do that, coming up next, just going to play some music for the next couple of minutes until they come on. And what else is there? Oh, did you hear that Disney bought Pixar? Be well. Be very, very well.